Okay, I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting to order. Let the record reflect it's Tuesday, February 24th at 3:30 p.m. We're in the Belts Committee Room in Juneau, Alaska, the state capital. Members present are Senator Gray Jackson and Senator Tilden and myself, Chair Kawasaki, the only ones we need. We also have Carrie Tupo from Senate Records and Chloe Miller, moderator with the Legislative Information Office. We have two items on today's agenda. The first item is an overview with the Department of Corrections. We have all of the corrections leadership here today. We also have a first hearing on Senate Bill 237. It is titled Data Sharing Social Security. It's by the Senate State Affairs Committee. So first, we'll go ahead and call up the Department of Corrections folks, Kevin Worley, Director of Administrative Services. We also have Zane Neiswanger, Director of Institutions. I'd like to welcome Vice Chair Senator Bjorkman, too. And if you could state your name and your affiliation, and you've got the presentation.
Good afternoon. My name is Kevin Worley. I'm the Director for the Division of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections.
Zane Neiswanger, Director of Institutions for the Department of Corrections.
So, again, for the record, Kevin Worley. Today we're here before you for a department overview for four specific items that were requested by the committee. The first series of questions we got felt better titled under institutions. Then we'll cover an area for healthcare. Our third area to cover would be recruitment, and then the final section will be repairs and maintenance. Moving on to slide two, as everyone knows, state government is famous for acronyms. So we too are famous for our acronyms. And here's a list of those that are described throughout the presentation today. If during the course of a presentation there is an acronym that we use in any of our discussions that you don't understand, please feel free to ask. All right, so moving on to slide three, I'm going to hand it off to Director Neiswanger, and he'll talk about the section for institutions.
Good afternoon. For the record, Zane Neiswanger, Director of Institutions for the Department of Corrections. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. We just have a brief high-level view of the Division of Institutions. So the Division of Institutions covers 13 adult correctional facilities that are strategically placed over our vast state. Each serves different purposes to meet security, programming, and classification requirements. The Division of Institutions is also responsible for 7 community residential centers. Those are our CRCs, or more commonly known as halfway houses. Central Classification Unit falls under Division of Institution, which ensures that prisoners are housed in the most appropriate facility based on security, programming, needs. And then our Central Transportation Unit, which is responsible for prisoner transportation throughout the state, also falls under this unit. Sentenced electronic monitoring, statewide chaplaincy, and our statewide PREA, which is the Prison Rape Elimination Act coordinator, falls under the division as well. Slide number four that is up is just a graph to show our facility capacity, and I'll just point out this is a snapshot in time. Overall, our department right now is at 91.7%, and that, again, just a snapshot of today, 91.7% of our general capacity. Our Central Classification Unit and Central Transportation Units have done a really excellent job of balancing our prisoner population, ensuring that our facilities operate at or below capacity on the average day. We do see moments in time where the population grows, but then there's procedures in place to draw those populations back down to a manageable number. I will point out just on this graph, the one obvious exception here is Spring Creek Correctional Center. And due to legislative intent language from last year, a house was closed at Spring Creek. And I'll just point out, we say a house closure, that's actually 4 living units, 4 mods that house 64 prisoners apiece in a general population housing unit. And so our population there has been operating at or close to our maximum capacity. And that's due to the prisoners that need to be there due to a higher security level. And so that is the most appropriate, the only appropriate facility for those prisoners to be housed at this time.
Thank you. I just wanted to welcome Senator Wilikowski, and Senator Bjorkman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here with us. Specifically, I'd like to chat a little bit about the situation at Spring Creek and how we arrived in this place. Personally, I noticed some intent language in the budget toward the end of session last year and asked questions about it. To the extent or not that your department was in agreement with that intent language, I can't say for sure. However, I know that conversations were had, and we know that intent language does not have the force of law. However, budgets being what they are, you all have limited resources. And I remember there was a general feeling that the closure of that housing unit at Spring Creek would be okay, as we've seen with a significant disturbance that took place last month at Spring Creek. It doesn't seem like things are okay. So how can the legislature help the Department of Corrections kind of mitigate this situation that we're facing now at Spring Creek with a reduction in capacity there, and you have people literally waiting to get in? What should we do?
There's some pointing.
I'm going to call out to a lifeline with the commissioner.
Thank you.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Great. Thank you. For the record, Jen Winkleman, Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. Through the chair to Vice Chair Bjorkman, thank you for the question. There's a lot to unpack with what you just asked. Essentially, the intent language also came with a huge reduction in funding. And so the department aimed to meet the intent language and is not finding the savings. And it is bottlenecking much of the, I would say, the incident that happened in Spring Creek is likely, anecdotally, a result of now having the worst of the worst. We don't have a varied population there. We now have it very much to our extreme behavior management problem. Whether that's accurate or not, these incidents can pop up at other places, but we certainly find that this was a gang. Our understanding is it was a gang fight in the yard and was likely a result of putting a lot of individuals into one spot. I think for us, for the department, once we did that in July and started moving prisoners all around, I can see where cutting a third of the budget, there's three houses at Spring Creek. So cutting a third of the budget makes sense just on paper. The reality is that we still need the staff to oversee and respond to other incidents. And I think the management of prisoners that are coming in daily throughout the system was something that has surprised us isn't a fair word, but it has bottlenecked other problems with regard to classification and moving prisoners around. So now to the question of what to do. And I think that comes with our funding that we are asking for with regard to whether that's our supplemental in 27, or I mean our supplemental for 26 or our mend in 27. Because it is, while that is focused on our staff and what is needed, the reality is that's what's needed to be able to manage this population. So I don't.
Very good. Thank you for that answer.
Yes.
And I certainly don't want the Department of Corrections or staff to feel like you all haven't done what we've asked you to do and that you all aren't doing the absolute best to do your jobs and keep bad guys locked up when they deserve to be there. We support you, and I certainly support you on behalf of my constituents around Seward and the people of Alaska who expect the bad guys to stay locked up. So What I would ask you to do in the future is please flag for the rest of the legislature what your needs are to meet your mission. And as personally in my views statewide, we can't pretend that things are going to be okay if we just have less money. Like, we don't live in this fairyland world where somehow we can go through a budgetary exercise of, oh yeah, we reduced by a third and so we can just cut a third of your budget. And, you know, we tried to fight a war like that once in our country. We had so many bullets, we're going to kill so many bad guys, and it didn't go well either, right? So please let me know and let the legislature know what you need to meet your mission, and don't be afraid to build a budget that reflects that and then defend it and then go forward and let us ask you questions about why. And please be able to keep bad guys in jail when they deserve to be there. That's what I would like to see happen. And I know that the public largely is in that place as well. So I want to support you, and I don't want to see happen what happened this past year ever again, where people, I think, maybe engage in some exercise that wasn't the most thoroughly vetted that it probably should have been. So please don't be afraid to advocate with me or the rest of my colleagues exactly what you need to meet your mission.
Through the chair to Vice Chair Bierkman, I very much appreciate you saying that. And the only piece that I would add on to that is that, and I think that's what is, and I recognize this is not a budget hearing, what becomes such a challenge with the corrections budget is not knowing who is going to be coming through our door, what medical needs they're going to have, or how long they're going to stay with us. And so we do these exercises and think, okay, we've got this such population, and then we get an influx of a different type of population. They may score out to be a maximum custody, and now that those vacant beds at Spring Creek are very much needed. So we are moving around that population on a daily basis, and I think, you know, that's where it becomes, we do our best guess at what we're going to get through the door.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. Question for you. In Spring Creek in just particular, it looks like you're right at capacity, snapshot for the day. How many of those people are in long-term maximum security versus how many are in some other form, pretrial or otherwise?
To the chair, I will let Director Neiswanger answer. My understanding is they are all sentenced. What their classification is, that part I'll let him speak to.
Thank you. Commissioner.
For the record again, Zane Neiswanger, to the chair, Senator Kawasaki. So the intent is that those are sentenced higher risk individuals that are housed at Spring Creek Correctional Center. I will say that sometimes we have unsentenced individuals that because of some sort of action, whether it be against staff or other inmates that determine that they're a more dangerous inmate, we may house them temporarily in their pretrial status at Spring Creek just because they're set up for that. But generally, it is a sentenced population designated there. And you'll have different custody levels there. We have everything from minimum to close custody at Spring Creek. We do maintain some minimum prisoners there for duties such as maintenance around the facility, groundskeeping, stuff like that, that are behaviorally sound and lower custody. But then we also have what I would call medium but close to close custody prisoners that are a little bit more dangerous and most appropriately housed there for a variety of reasons.
And then, Mr. Neiswanger, if another of the Spring Creek houses were to shutter, to what facility would those folks go?
Yeah, that's to the chair. That's an impossible question for me to answer. And what I would say is this: there is nowhere else for that population to go right now, not in that quantity. We can take smaller amounts of inmates and move them around to different facilities that can house close custodies that their security elements are built out for that purpose. But we don't have anywhere to absorb those numbers of dangerous prisoners around the state.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Yeah. Has there been any investigation of what caused the fight at Spring Creek?
Through the chair to Senator Kaus, or to, sorry, Senator Wilikowski. Yes, there has.
Do you have a copy that we can have?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski. I believe we can get you that. I don't see a reason why we couldn't.
Yeah. Can you summarize the conclusions?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, it had to do with some, the basis of it was some money owed from one prisoner to another prisoner. Tensions are high. There was some race-based, two gangs, both race-based. The one person didn't want to deal with their problem with the other person. Tensions were rising between the two groups, and they decided to settle it gang to gang, group to group.
Follow up?
And I'm just curious, was the department aware that these, there was this conflict that was brewing, or was this a surprise, or?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, we had some information of some conflict, but nothing that we expected to ever rise to this level.
Again, not being critical of the correction officers involved or anything of that nature. Just trying to understand what, was this a funding issue? Was this just something that at your existing levels could have, could you have just maybe segregated them or dealt with it in a different way that doesn't involve funding?
Oh, through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, I don't know that I completely understand the question. If I might repeat it, like what I think. So you're wondering ahead of time or right after the event, ahead of time?
Again, just, Mr. Chair, if I could. We the governor submitted a $2 billion deficit to us, and we're trying to figure out ways that we can save money and ways that we can, and of course in a way that we don't want outbreaks like this to occur in our correction system. Could something have been done differently that would have averted this conflict?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, that's a tough question to answer. I think it's a good question. I think hindsight's 20/20, and I think it's easy to look at it after the fact and be like, well, that warning sign or this warning sign that didn't seem so big at the time, maybe we should have paid more attention. I think that's absolutely fair. What I would say is, you put more people in a house. I mean, I just think of, and if I might be permitted a little opportunity here just to expound a little bit, like in my own house, like you put too many people in my house. I got guests there for too long and too many of them. Tensions start to rise. Company after a few days or a crowded house after a few days starts to get everybody on edge a little bit. And I think that that's a direct result. I believe 100% we have the right prisoners in the right place when we're talking about Spring Creek. Those are our more volatile, more dangerous offenders. And I think that the house closure there led to more attention. While I don't think that we saw this coming, not in the size that it presented itself in, I think that it's predictable that tensions are going to be higher when you have more prisoners than you could have in a certain location cooped up.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
If I'm reading this chart correctly, look, are we at maximum capacity or at general capacity at this facility?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, so we're operating at or close to maximum capacity on a regular basis at Spring Creek right now.
So what I'm hearing from you is that you have it indicated at maximum capacity, but really maximum capacity should be less than what you're indicating there.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that's correct. We should be operating at or below general capacity. Maximum capacity is higher, and we should not be operating sustained periods of time at those numbers.
Senator Wilikowski.
And you're still operating at maximum capacity now?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, yes, we are.
Do you expect outbreaks like this to continue to occur?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, I think we've identified some of the tensions there and separated the parties. And we're going to be monitoring things a little bit closer, of course, after the event. I mean, that's part of the hindsight 2020 is we realize we need to pay closer attention right now. I'll just point out we have the facilities at or near max capacity on a regular basis, and we also have a waiting list of prisoners that should be in Spring Creek that can't go right now. So there's not only the prisoners that are currently there, but there's more that need to go there as well.
Follow up.
So what do you need from us to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, we need more space at Spring Creek, and I hope I'm not getting ahead of folks with that, but that's my two cents for it.
Yep, go ahead. Senator Wilikowski.
Is there a capital request for more space at Spring Creek in the proposed budget?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, there's not a capital request for that, but through our operating ask for our supplemental and then for our 27, we do have a $20 million increment request through institutions. So we were looking at a decrement of the there are $6 million decrement for ACOA letter of agreement that we had for overtime pay, and then we had the $7.5 million reduction for the closure of the wing at Spring Creek, but nothing in capital.
And if I could
go ahead.
Am I hearing you need more cap? You need more money for capital expenditures? I thought that's what I heard you say. You said you needed more space.
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, just more space to house prisoners at Spring Creek.
Okay. But you're not asking for more space. Is that correct?
No. Yeah. Okay.
Commissioner Winkleman.
For the record, Jen Winkleman, Commissioner for the Department. The space is still, the space is there. The house is closed right now. And also through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, when the incident occurred, we used it as emergency housing. We had to separate people immediately, and we opened it back up to move folks in. And then we've done our best to identify and move people around. So it is there. So there is no capital request. And then, and essentially, due to vacancies, due to our staffing profile, the funding that is being requested in our budget right now would brings us back up to being able to have staff for that unit as well. So it's not necessarily the space as opposed. I understood your question. Okay. So great. Hopefully
thank
that
you
helps.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director. I got a question then. Again, it's sort of regarding where these potential folks could be moved if there were room in other facilities across the state. And I'm hearing that there's no room in any other facilities in any part of the state. And we've been at 100% capacity from time to time over the last two decades. So we're at 91 today as a snapshot. I'm just curious, you know, is there another wing and another module somewhere in another facility that might be able to more properly house, you know, part of the gang or, you know, to separate them out into different facilities?
To the chair, Senator Kawasaki, again, Zane Nicewanger for the record. So you'll notice on the graph there are some spaces where we've got some white between our capacities and our prisoner population. I will point out that that does not mean that we necessarily just have prisoners room to move prisoners around. And one of the other concerns is if we look at a few of those, and I was just kind of looking at them as you're talking there, you know, we've got Bethel on the far right. We've got Goose Creek, which is a minimum medium security facility, not appropriate for the security level of the prisoners. You know, Fairbanks is predominantly a pretrial facility. You got the Point McKenzie Farm, definitely not a fit for the folks that would be at Spring Creek. So there's not the room. And again, I would point out we've got 80 prisoners on a wait list to go to Spring Creek, and I'm totally pulling that number out of the air. I think it's close, but please don't hold me to it. It's a few, quite a few. And so what I would say is the space isn't where we need it right now to move those particular prisoners.
Thank you. Senator Bjorkman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, just by way of commentary here, I recall having a conversation similar to this one last year and years previous when Spring Creek did have more capacity. And we discussed during those meetings about why capacity was available there for some of the safety reasons you mentioned, as well as the ability to move prisoners back and forth based on the needs of those folks, the training opportunities that they might need or rehabilitation opportunities that they might need in other facilities or other things like that. So the conversation that you're seeing here, I think, is really an outgrowth of budgetary decisions that were made by a different committee that we had less input into. And I'll just flag again, please keep legislators aware of what the realities are of your budget so that we can advocate for what it is you all need to meet your mission. Is really important. Thank you.
Through the chair. Thank you, Senator Bjorkman.
I think we can move to the next slide.
All right. So the next slide is fairly simple. This breaks down our prisoner population by gender and then by sentenced and unsentenced status. And I'll just point out, this is a snapshot just from today, the numbers I'm about to give you, and that is that we are currently at 43% unsentenced population and 57% sentenced. And that's a trend in the very positive direction. I would say that we've seen a lot of improvement in these numbers. They've sort of flipped over the last year, year and a half, which is good. And we've seen a lot of improvement due to the Department of Law and the courts working to clear the backlogs post-COVID.
Director, on the unsentenced population, I know that the numbers decreased or the percents decreased. Why is it that high? And is it still impacts of COVID? Is it impacts of cases that have not gone to trial? You seem to be holding a lot of folks that are in the system but not haven't gone through trial, I guess.
Yeah, to the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I feel like we're heading in the right direction, but we're not there yet. I believe as there's a continued push from Department of Law and the courts, I think we're going to arrive at healthier numbers, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
So the Chief Justice of the court system said that that was an issue where they are trying to fill up the backlog. They had a backlog. It was caused by COVID was one of the things, and then some of it has to do with continuances at the legal level, at the criminal justice level. Out of that unsentenced population, are there some folks that could leave that choose not to leave? Leave as in beyond a pretrial status of some sort or left on their own recognizance?
To the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I'm going to look around here in a second. I don't have direct knowledge of that. That would be more our pretrial unit that could probably answer that question. And I'm not sure if we've got somebody on the line that could answer that.
Anybody? And if not, if you don't have the numbers at your fingertips, okay, then we will just at some point send you a request directly. Thank you, Ms. Wilkerson.
All right. Thank you very much. So the next area of the slideshow is going to be on the healthcare side, and we're bringing forward Travis Walsh, who's the Director of Health and Rehabilitation Services. So Travis's section will cover the services that are provided by the Department of Corrections for medical, dental, and other mental health, et cetera.
Good afternoon. Through the chair, I'm Travis Welsh, the Director of Health and Rehabilitation Services for the Alaska Department of Corrections. Excuse me. My background is law enforcement, so I also love my acronyms. And when you get into healthcare within the law enforcement community, those acronyms might be a little different. So I will try to remember. I don't think all of mine made the front page there, so I'll try to remember to spell those out as I go through my presentation. Thank you, Senator. So within the Department of Corrections, it's healthcare within our system is very unique. Our inmate population, those in our care and custody, our patients, they're guaranteed healthcare services. It's a right that they enjoy under the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and also under the State of Alaska Constitution. They have the right to medical care and also the right to rehabilitation. Approximately 90 to 95% of people leaving our care and custody will return to their communities. And our goal is to, as our guiding principles from our commissioner of state, that people leave us better than they came to us, with the hopes that they'll have the skills and ability to be gainfully employed and not come back to our care and custody. Our population is also very acute. We end up housing people who are more likely to have a chronic disease ranging from asthma to diabetes to cancer. They're also more likely than the general population to be living with a substance use disorder, mental illness, and even for dental care. They're 9 times more likely to have a dental infection or a cavity than your general population. 44% are living with a mental illness in our population. One thing that I do want to, and also with our population, we have a great partnership with community partners. We do rely on our community healthcare providers. While we do have quite a few services in-house that we're able to provide, we do partner with other outside medical facilities to provide levels of care that we can't provide within our population. That has resulted in 2025 in 5,926 outside medical appointments, but I will highlight that that number is down nearly 1,000 from the previous year. We've done quite a bit of work within our medical and behavioral services to try and reduce the number of outside medical appointments for our population, not just as a cost containment method or a measure, but also for our population. It's safer for our population, also for the public, for us to not have to take people out of our facilities when we can avoid that. One thing I also do want to highlight, you'll see there that we talk a little bit about, or that we have the bullet point, opioid and alcohol detox. This is something that we hear quite a bit about when we talk about the opioid epidemic and different issues within substance abuse. For our population during FY25, our nurses within DOC conducted 52,843 detox assessments for people coming into our care and custody. For nursing hours, that equates to between almost 4,500 nursing hours to almost 9,000 nursing hours. Some things that stand out with that breakdown, for opioid abuse, those detox assessments were 26,180, and for alcohol, it was 26,663. And this stands out to me because normally we see a lot more alcohol detox assessments than we do opioid, but that number, that gap, is, at least for last fiscal year, was starting to close. That came out to 6,323 people being placed on full protocols. When people come into our care and custody, one of the first people they're going to see is one of our DOC nurses. We really appreciate the work of our nurses. They're very busy and they work really hard. And they're going to go through a healthcare screening with that individual. And they're going to hit on all kinds of different things, what their health history is. They're also going to assess the person for suicidality. And they're also going to ask that person about their substance abuse history, if they have one. Certain things are going to flag to where we are going to make sure we pay attention, special attention to that person, and we provide those assessments so that we can ensure that they're safe while they're in our care and custody. Some of those things, if we see somebody who we know comes to us on a regular basis, for example, our highest utilizer of detox protocols came into our care and custody and required detox protocols 14 times. During this 1 year. So when people come to us who we normally see coming in with the blood alcohol level, let's just say 0.2, 0.3 even, and they come to us and they're at zeros, that's a huge flag for us to know that we need to watch that person. Because within 48 to 72 hours, there's a high likelihood they're going to experience detox. The detox protocol is a joint effort. It's a group effort among our nurses, our security staff to watch those individuals, our providers to provide medications when needed, and also to where if their condition gets beyond our ability to provide care, we get them to the appropriate emergency room provider. But this is just something we wanted to highlight as we talk about the acuity and the complexity of our population that we're providing services for.
There's a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Yes, sir. What percentage of the inmate medical treatment is covered by the federal government, would you say?
So that's a great question, and through the chair to Senator Wilikowski. With our population, the vast majority of medical services are general funds. The inmate exclusion for Medicaid is a rule within Medicare law, that when somebody's incarcerated, their Medicaid is either turned off or paused, and Medicaid only kicks in when somebody is receiving care in an inpatient facility outside of the Department of Corrections. Freedom of movement, where they lay their head at night, is kind of one of those gauges we use to know whether or not Medicaid will be turned on and cover the care for that person. So it's mostly general funds.
Senator Wilikowski, follow up.
Are you seeing people coming, getting arrested upon your belief to get medical treatment or so that they have a place to sleep?
So that is an excellent question, and through the chair to Senator Wilikowski. This year we attended AFN, the Alaska Federation of Natives conference in Anchorage. We attended a listening session having to do it that was related to the report that was provided through HB 66, I believe it was. And as we sat around the talking circle, I was there, and Director Nyswanger, Deputy Commissioner Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff, a number of us from leadership were there. And one of the things that really stood out to me, because this is one of those things that you hear anecdotally, right, that we believe to be true. But there was a woman sitting next to me, a younger female, probably early 20s or so, who was unhoused. She was homeless. And one of the things that she said that really stood out to me is that when she or her friends need a place to sleep, or they need medical care, they need food, it's easy to pick up a trespass charge and get what they need within the Department of Corrections.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Do you have any recommendations on things that we can do to prevent this? Because these people, they would be eligible for Medicaid if they were out of prison, but now they're going into prison. The state has to pick up the cost through the general fund. Do you have any suggestions for us on how we can deal with this?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, again, I appreciate the question. So in my previous life, I worked for the Alaska Mental Health Trust. I was a program officer there working on criminal justice issues. And the trust was engaged a lot with work around diversion programs. Crisis Now, many of you have probably heard of that. And just those community programs to where they provide that safety net for people not to end up in the Department of Corrections. I'll just say, when you look at the sequential intercept model, 0 to 5 intercepts, each one is where people can be connected to services. The more downstream you go, 0 to 1 intercept, the more payers there are to come to the table to provide care or payment for care for those individuals, taking some of that burden off of the state. But really, it's a group effort. One of the things that in an earlier committee hearing that the commissioner talked about is you know, a group coming together to discuss the overall system issue that we're looking at within our criminal justice system, within our behavioral health system, and how can we come up with strategies to best address that system.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski.
I don't recall seeing any proposed legislation coming out in the last 7.5 years dealing with this issue. It seems to be, the philosophy seems to be, well, let's just lock them up. And I think the public needs to understand that there's a huge cost to that. And do you have any suggestions for legislation? Have you discussed that with other people in your department? Is that something that you could provide us with that we could start to really take a look at? It's not going to happen probably this year, but maybe for future legislatures to look at to try to deal with this situation with we're pushing up against caps, maximum population caps on most of our prisons, if not almost all of our prisons.
So through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, a couple of years ago there was legislation that passed dealing with crisis stabilization services that made it to where it expanded ways or places that people can go to receive crisis services beyond just your normal DETs or your designated evaluation treatment facilities like at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital, Mat-Su Hospital, or the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. We actually do see that there have been services stood up under the Crisis Now model, such as in Fairbanks where they have mobile crisis teams. Anchorage has a number of teams as well. South Central Foundation is currently building a crisis stabilization center where individuals will be able to go. That's a no-wrong-door facility, so they won't say no when people come in, and it'll serve all populations. And I believe in Fairbanks also, the Alaska Behavior Health Organization is also looking to establish a crisis stabilization center there as well. So there are organizations that are coming together and wanting to stand up these services or standing up these services. The Anchorage Fire Department has a mobile crisis team, and Anchorage Police Department also has their mobile crisis teams. That's an officer paired with a clinician. We actually, our clinicians meet with those teams to communicate about individuals who are shared patients. So there are different things happening. It's just kind of a slow boat to turn sometimes.
Any other questions? Okay, next slide.
So through the chair, when we talk about medical services within the Department of Corrections, so we do have quite a bit of capacity and capability to provide medical services. We operate three infirmaries within our system, one at Highland Mountain, that's for our female population, one at Goose Creek, and one at Anchorage Correctional Complex, ACC, for our male populations. These infirmaries are able to provide an inpatient level of care up to a certain point. When individuals do go beyond our capabilities within those infirmaries, we do seek outside medical care for those individuals. If they're an inpatient for more than 24 hours, Medicaid is an option to cover the cost of care for those patients. Nurses are the backbone of the services we provide. We do have 24-hour coverage in a number of our facilities that have our most acute populations, such as those intake facilities like the Anchorage Correctional Complex. We also operate a 4-bed dialysis clinic at Goose Creek. So for those patients who need dialysis and are able to be housed at Goose Creek, we're able to provide that. That gives us considerable cost containment because dialysis is not cheap. It's $11,000 per treatment per patient. So that's a big win for our patients, for our population, and for our budget. We currently have three individuals receiving dialysis at Goose Creek right now. So you do the math on 11,000 times 3 times 3 times a week times 52 weeks, it gets pretty spendy. Also, we have really great partnerships with the Department of Health and with the Department of Family Community Services that I'd also like to highlight, where we are able to currently partner with the Department of Health through the Department of Behavior Health on a MOUD, that's a medication opioid use disorder, medications for opioid use disorders, MOUD. And we have a pilot project that we're working on right now down in Wildwood for those individuals releasing with an opioid addiction to where we'll be able to provide medications to treat that addiction and connect them to services upon their release. Is a big part of that program. We want that continuity of care for those individuals so that when they leave us, they don't relapse and continue on with their addiction. Also, another, we are working to become more efficient and effective within our division. Telehealth services is a big part of that. Like I mentioned before, we want to try to limit the number of times people have to leave our care and custody for additional services. And what telehealth is one of our strategies for being able to do so. That we have a partnership with the Department of Behavioral Health, where they have provided us with grant funding that they've received to expand our use of telehealth. And then another tool that we're using is eConsult, where individuals, you know, using technology, where individuals who need a referral to an outside provider for a specialist, we have specialists who can go in and access our electronic health record, look at that individual's chart, and then provide treatment options for us so that we can provide the treatment within our facility. We're also expanding the use of physical therapy and other lower-level, less invasive medical treatments rather than going straight from, you hurt your knee, let's go get surgery. We want to try to use physical therapy and other levels of care prior to that more expensive and invasive procedure.
Before you move on, I had a question about just the use of parole and particularly things like if a person has, you know, cancer, needing cancer treatment, or you mentioned dialysis at a huge cost. Are those, I'm not sure if you know those particular cases, but are any of them, is medical parole available to any of those folks?
Great question, and through the chair, to the chair. Our role with when it comes to medical parole is to, when individuals, when we're alerted, whether that's through the institutional probation officers, through our medical social workers, or individuals looking at these cases, our role is to provide a medical summary to the parole board so they have the information that they need to be able to make the best decision for public safety of the state.
And we might eventually talk to the parole board here, but can you tell me if a person is it exclusively based on public safety, or are there other factors in debating medical parole in particular?
Through the chair, I do believe that would be a question for the parole board. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you. The Department of Corrections is also the largest provider of mental health services within the state of Alaska. We have inpatient acute levels of care at the Anchorage Correctional Complex and also at Highland Mountain for our men's and then our women's populations. Then we also have a number of subacute inpatient beds within our system. All in all, we have just over or more than 300 inpatient beds within our system. Just for comparison, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute has about 80. So just to kind of highlight the acuity of our population. We also, within our facilities, do provide also substance use disorder treatment, SUD. We have residential treatment within a number of our facilities and also outpatient treatment programs within a number of our facilities. And then, of course, our sex offender management program. That's offered in a number of our facilities, and then also in our community corrections, and telehealth is an option for individuals living in rural Alaska who require sex offender management programming. One other partnership that we appreciate is our partnership with the Alaska Psychiatric Institute with the Department of Family and Community Services, where we've partnered for a jail-based restoration program for those people who are what we refer to as Title 12, or they're not competent to stand trial and they require require restoration services. That is operated within at our ACC facility on our Lima Mod, which is our subacute unit, where the API providers come into the facility to do the restorative work for up to 10 individuals in our care and custody. And that's to kind of expand their capacity for their programs. We also are we're excited to talk to the Department of Behavioral Health. We've had a number of we've attended various meetings, and I'm sure everybody's heard of the Rural Health Transformation Program, to see what technologies may be leveraged or other opportunities that we have for funding to provide services, whether it's using technology to improve our communication with our partner organizations or even wearable medical devices to better monitor our population. And then the third leg of of our division, HARS, is our reentry education and vocational programs. We really emphasize engagement with our community partners like the reentry coalitions. Our reentry services host and bring in outside partners into the facilities for what we refer to as in-reach activities, where we have large scale. It's almost like kind of like a, when you go to like a job shop, one of those job seeking, I can't think of the name of it, but like, job, you know, fair. Job fair. Thank you. Yes, Senator. Job fair style program where you have tables set up, providers sitting at those tables, and then those individuals getting ready to release can come in, see what services are there, and start to connect with those organizations. We also, our educational and vocational programs, we focus on adult education, so trying to assist people to get their GEDs. If they don't have a high school diploma or GED when they come into our care and custody, and also vocational programming. We have a number of partnerships with different vocational organizations. We really like to highlight our partnership with the iron workers, with different unions. The iron workers and the carpenters union, is those are two of our partners that we're really excited about. Our goal is to, as people come into our care and custody, like I said before, to get them the services that they need to be stable, and then also get them education and vocational services so that they have a skill when they leave us, whether that's a CDL for them to be able to be, to drive trucks, you know, up and down the highway, on the slope, or to get them into the Carpenters Union when they release.
All right. Thank you, Travis. Excuse me, Director Walsh. The next section is going to be information related to the recruitment for the Department of Corrections. So on slide 12, this is a current statewide, Kevin Worley, Division of Administrative Services, Department of Corrections. So this is a department position count for the Department of Corrections. You'll see on the far left that over a five-month period where we newly filled 128 positions, we also had a loss of 178, so a net loss of 50 positions. How does that relate to the graph down below? Well, if you'll notice the black and the red lines, 23 and 24, you'll see that they remain relatively flat throughout the calendar year. And when you look at the green line for 25, you'll notice that we actually started above 23 and 24, but over that time frame, we've actually gone below, as of November, below the 23 low. So that net decrease is reflected, and we feel it within the department. Any questions on this? Okay. All right. So on slide 13, this relates to the correctional officer vacancies that we have within each of the different institutions. Institutions are listed on the left with the CO counts for 1, 2, 3, and 4 with supervisors and total budgeted positions within the department broken down by the institutions. On the table to the right, as of February 9th, you'll see the number of positions that are currently filled within each of those institutions. You'll see a column next to it of CJOs, which is a conditional job offer with a start date, meaning that we've made a job offer, the person is accepted, we've issued them a start date, but they're not yet working in an institution. So we do have that job offer out. Next column is total vacant by that particular institution, and you'll see on the far right those vacancy percentages that we have. Now, the vacancy percentages, for example, you know, if we look at Spring Creek, which is SCCC, you'll see that they're at a 26.77% vacancy. and not only Spring Creek, but each of the institutions that are listed there, if there's other, this is like recruitment vacancy, but then we have to take into account, you know, if people are on leave or if people are in any sort of FEMLA or any reason where they're not able to work, the operational capacity is much higher than what we're currently seeing on the recruitment vacancy, just because there's not bodies on the floor. So in order to fill those vacancies within an institution, we're going to have to pay overtime. One other thing to note is, I believe last year at this time we reported out that we were at roughly a less than 5% vacancy rate, and this year we're up over 12 at the same time.
Mr. Worley, Director Worley, are those from mostly retirements or mostly coming in and out?
For that particular question, I think I would call on our HR staff for that. Is that something I can do? No? Yeah. So I'll have Carrie Johnson. She's our human resource business partner for the Department of Corrections.
I guess. Only if you've got an answer. Otherwise, we can take it as a question. But.
For the record, Carrie Johnson, human resources for the Department of Corrections. Some of them are retirements, resignations, people move out of state, et cetera. And then we also have not been able to hire as many last year as we did the year before.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Personally, I know folks that are retiring this year that are COs that have been with the system for a long time. On the next slide, or the slide here, how to apply. This is basically a 24/7 recruitment effort. So this is online for folks to check out the Department of Corrections. There's videos, job postings. Basically, we're recruiting just as much as the staff are working, 24/7, 365. The issues that we have within the state, commissioners and deputy commissioners for the department both indicated, this is a nationwide issue. You know, it's not just the state of Alaska having this issue. We're hearing about it nationwide. The other thing that we're, you know from talking with CEOs, or maybe you know some personally, it's a difficult job to recruit for. It's a difficult position. Having been out at the institutions myself, taking different tours, I've been to a little over half of those, and that's not a job I would do. If I was 25, I still wouldn't do that job. But I appreciate the folks that do, because I know that's a very tough job. And Director Nieswanger has been there. I've heard some of the stories that he's told, just confirming that that's not a job for me, but it is a job for other folks, and there are folks that would appreciate that job. And we'd like to find them.
You want to work?
No. Okay. So, additionally, to add, you know, we've had staff traveling through airports, and when staff indicated, you know, they were talking to TSA and handed off a business card and said, "Hey, you know, take a look at the Department of Corrections." And we recently had a meeting with the Coast Guard, and they were interested in some of the things that the department provided in terms of jobs. And you know, for folks either looking to get out of the Coast Guard or retiring from the Coast Guard and taking up a second career, because these folks have experience using guns, have experience dealing with security. So that was something that, you know, was nice to see and hear. And they were very enthused when talking about that particular option for their folks. And then the last slide for this particular section, just to give you an idea of what it's looking like. So right now, we're looking at an average of 99 days to complete from beginning to end the recruitment process. Shortest amount of time was 34 days. It was shared with me that, you know, this is a huge accomplishment compared to what the department was going through a few years back, where it from start to finish was taking over a year. So the transformation that the recruitment and retention section has done in this particular area has been fantastic. All right. So moving on to repairs and maintenance, this section is in particular, you know, is dealing with our institutions. We do have a number of institutions. Obviously, you know, you've seen some of the capital projects that we go through. But before I get into this section, you know, one of the things that the Department of Corrections gets is a delegation from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. So in that respect, we have authority up to projects of $500,000 that the department can work on to, so that, you know, we're dealing with them, we're dealing with the contractors. And then periodically we could get authority from DOT for projects that are over $500,000. So we'll have some examples on the next slides here where we're talking about some of the work that's already been done. Or projects that we have in place. This particular project, we have two projects here from Point McKinsey Correctional Farm, and this is a fully functioning farm producing produce. We got potatoes, they got farm animals out there. And the great thing that this facility does is it produces fresh produce for the department. We've also been able to get some out to some organized charities. Also, it's a cost avoidance item for the department where we're able to use the vegetables that we're producing here for other facilities. So that helps maintain or, you know, reduce some of the food costs that we're experiencing at different facilities. The other thing that we were able to do is get this out to, like, Nome and Bethel. So gotten out to those areas. On the bottom right are some new housing units that we had actually gotten from Elmendorf Air Force Base, and these were items that we had transported here. They were replacing items that were from the 60s, so definitely older buildings. We salvaged as much as we could off those older buildings, burned them, and put in these new facilities that were built by the wonderful staff at Point McKinsey Farm. The maintenance crew there is amazing. Just like at any of our institutions, they have a lot of daily work that they have to do in order to maintain the safety and security, not only for our staff, but then the folks that, you know, are within the facilities. Not exactly sure how to do a video on this, Joe. Do I just press it? So this is a video from the vegetable processing plant at Point McKinsey. Just a very short video, but it shows you like the washing table that they have for, in this case, the potatoes. So would you like to speak to Point McKinsey? No? Okay. So I was just recently out at the farm, and it was amazing the things that they have done at that place, with the fixing of the barn roof and the things that potatoes that they're growing. What was that tent that we were looking at? There was it spinach or yeah. Was it spinach?
Bok choy.
Spinach. Oh, bok choy and stuff like that. So they're doing those kinds of growing of stuff. It was really cool. That was the first time I'd been out there, and I really enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. Here's another project that we were working on, just to give you an example of some of the things we deal with. So on a daily basis, here we replace corroded and plugged pipes for Matsu Boiler. So this is a facility at a pretrial facility out in Palmer. The next item are some of the projects that we have on our statewide capital project listing. So in the case of Anvil Mountain, we're looking at windows and door replacements. Some doors don't close properly. The safety doors, fortunately, we keep getting repaired, so there's no issue with those. But there's other doors that maybe staff are going through. I haven't been to this particular facility, but at Highland, you know, we have similar situations with those. And staff, we have, like I said, amazing maintenance folks that are very creative on how they fix things and where they can get stuff. I understand that there are some parts that they had to get from eBay, for example, that maybe were not carried by the place that made the product, but those items were available online. And here's our last picture. This one relates to the radios and repeaters at Wildwood. So we're dealing with a number of radios here that, you know, still work, but they're at end of life, end of parts. We have a wonderful radio shop at the Department of Public Safety that does the work for the Department of Corrections and making sure our radios and repeaters are working correctly. So, you know, we have a really good relationship with those folks. We're at a point now, like at Wildwood, where for the safety of our officers, we should be upgrading and replacing those near end-of-life products with newer technology. So that's where we're at with this particular project. It just started. We've gone, issued the order, and we should be working on this project real soon. And then just to wrap up, we have a number of projects on our capital project list. This is not a complete listing by any means, but these are just projects that were brought forward by my facilities staff. You know, they're a great group, too. They work wonderfully with each of the maintenance teams at each of the institutions, as well as making sure our bigger projects are continuing to work. So there's a number of doors and window projects, underground storage tank issues, roof fixing and replacement. Looking at slide 23, one item that both Director Nieswanger and I saw on a visit to Ketchikan just a few months back, there's a wall along the right side. If you're facing the facility, there's a rock wall that is built up along the side of it. And there's been sloughing of the rock off that wall. So it's been getting onto some of the security trails. The concern that we were having with those rocks is potentially falling and hitting oil tanks and or generators within that facility. And that's also obviously a safety concern for our security staff that have to patrol the exterior of the facility. So with that wraps up our discussion on the four items that were requested by the committee, and we're open for any questions. My favorite legislative liaison, Rachel Turner, will be more than happy to take any of those questions.
I don't see any further questions at this point. We do appreciate you folks coming in and giving us a great deal of information to look at. We probably will have some follow-up questions, and we will deliver those to Ms. Turner.
All right. Thank you very much.
Great.
Appreciate
Thank
your time.
You. We're going to go ahead and take a brief at ease and set up for our final hearing. All right, I'll call the Senate State Affairs Committee meeting back to order. We next have a hearing on Senate Bill 237, Data Sharing Social Security. Jenna Calhoun, staff to the Senate State Affairs Committee, will come up and present the bill. We also have online some invited testimony as well.
Hello, for the record, Jenna Calhoun, staff to Senator Kawasaki. I am presenting SB 237, an act relating to data sharing by the Department of Administration for driver's license data verification purposes and providing for an effective date. Senate Bill 237 makes changes to the Alaska statute to allow Alaskans to apply online to replace a lost Social Security card. We are the only state in the union that does not allow for a fully online process for this common occurrence. Currently, citizens must either travel to one of the three Social Security Administration offices in Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau, or mail in their sensitive documents to those locations to replace a lost card. This practice is time-consuming, costly, and inefficient. The hardship of not enacting SB 237 would be felt the most by our rural communities. They would travel hundreds of miles at their own expense to verify their identity in person. For those unable to afford travel, mailing their original documents is their only option. Mail service in rural Alaska is less reliable than in city centers, which means a person's driver's license, passport, or birth certificate can get lost in the mail. The entire process of mailing original documents to replace a lost Social Security card can take up to 45 days, leaving the citizen unable to verify their identity during that time. Enacting SB 237 and enabling Alaskans to apply for a lost Social Security card online would eliminate several barriers rural Alaskans face in this process. They would no longer have to spend money traveling to a city center or fear that their sensitive documents would be lost in the mail. It would also be convenient for our urban citizens who would appreciate the time saved in their days. I urge you to support me in the passage of SB 237 to eliminate the barriers to replacing a lost Social Security card for all citizens of Alaska. And I also do have a presentation if the committee would be happy to have me present it.
Yes, if you would present the presentation.
Awesome. So what does SB 237 do? First off, it amends AS 28.05.068 to allow the Department of Administration to share data with the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators. And what this organization is, it is an organization that consists of American and Canadian officials that are responsible for administering and enforcing motor vehicle laws, and it provides a variety of technology services. The most important in this context is the driver's license data verification service. Right now, 44 states are participating with no restrictions, 5 are participating with SSA only, and Alaska is under review. So we're the only ones who do not participate with the AAMVA. Then the second section would amend AS 28.05068B to allow the Department of Administration to convey, distribute, or communicate data to a private entity to carry out the provisions of AS 28.15151, which deals with the sharing of an individual's abstract of their driving record, which includes their full name, their date of birth, as well as their driver's license number, their address, and the issue state of their driver's license. Now, the office was very concerned about Alaskans' private data, so we added Section 3, which amends AS 28.15.151, by adding subsection G to protect Alaskans' data by ensuring that it is only shared with a nonprofit organization that's defined by one that is under a 503C, a governmental or a tribal entity. So why do we need SB 237? Well, again, we want to make sure that we are bringing Alaska into the future. We are a digital nation, and this would make it so we could have a digital way to replace a lost Social Security card. We are the only state that does not allow for this at this point in time. Each year, over 15,000 Alaskans need a replacement Social Security card, and I will say that I am actually one of those people. And then in order to do that, they must travel to Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Juneau. These are our urban city centers, but most of our Alaskans do not live in those city centers. So the Alaskans that would have to travel, especially those in the rural part of the state, they would have to spend time, money, and it's stress to do this very simple process. So SB 237 would modernize the Social Security card process and eliminate unneeded travel for our rural citizens. And if y'all had any questions, I would love to take them at this time.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much for the presentation. At this time, we're going to go ahead and open up some invited testimony. And we have with us, Dustin Brown. Dustin Brown's the Chief of Staff to the Social Security Administration. I have a brief No, I guess I don't. If you could introduce yourself, Mr. Brown, and state your affiliation for the record, I appreciate you giving us a call from Washington, D.C. in D.C. time.
Chairman Kawasaki, it's wonderful to be with you. I am Dustin Brown. I'm the head of legislative affairs at the Social Security Administration. I've spent about 25 years as a career civil servant working to improve government services to the public across time at the Office of Management and Budget and the last 2 years at Social Security Administration. While I regret I can't be there in person, I've really enjoyed the opportunity to travel to meet a number of senators, representatives, and their staff a couple of weeks ago, and been enjoying a chance to continue to follow progress on this important legislation. I won't repeat the items that your colleague did such a wonderful job introducing. I will just kind of reinforce that Alaska is the only state in the country that does not allow their residents to request a Social Security card online. This happens about every 10 minutes. A resident in Alaska comes into a Social Security office requesting a replacement card. It is the most common reason people are coming into Social Security offices, and it is something that can be processed online typically in 7 to 10 days. That is something that other states have been able to take advantage of. I think the stories that I've heard from our Social Security office in Juneau, and I think that's true in the other offices as well, of people having to spend hundreds of dollars on plane tickets or ferry trips and hotels and food expenses to be able to come into a Social Security office to get something that they could be getting very simply online is one that we are certainly compelled by. It also has the benefit of freeing up scarce Social Security employee time to focus on more complex issues, such as disability or SSI claims that would better serve, we believe, the residents of Alaska than something that could be done through Social Security card offices and free up valuable resources. One other thing I would just note, the data protection, data privacy issue that was raised, it's worth noting that the checks are only initiated by individuals requesting a replacement card, not the Social Security Administration. The data is not sent to the Social Security Administration, but SSA receives a simple true-false response based on the results of the data verification that it does through the AMVA nonprofit intermediary that was mentioned. AMVA also does not store any data and deletes any information immediately after the verification. Their online service has undergone comprehensive cybersecurity testing and is accessible only through a secure My Social Security portal. So with that, I am happy to be available to ask any questions and appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Great. Thank you again for your testimony, Mr. Brown. Thank you for spending time here in Juneau. We just got another probably foot of snow in this past several hours. Are there any questions for Mr. Brown? Okay. Hearing and seeing none, once again, we appreciate your time. Is there anybody else online to testify? Is there anybody in the room who'd like to testify? We'll go ahead and open up public testimony. Anybody in the room or online who'd like to testify to Senate Bill 237? All right. Are there any last questions before we set Senate Bill 237 aside? All right. Hearing none. We will go ahead and hold Senate Bill 237 for further hearings. That concludes the meeting for today. We will have another meeting on Thursday, February 26th. We will hear a presentation by the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and the Systems to Address Them by Brenda Stanfield, the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We will hear Senate Bill 236, Veterans Sentence Program Criminal Procedure by Senator Tobin. We will also hear Senate Bill 162, Specie as a Legal Tender by Senator Cronk. If there's no other business to come before the Senate State Affairs Committee, we are adjourned. Let the record reflect that it is 4:52.